From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Republican Party loses its fight to keep protesters out of sight at its convention.
The judge ruled that the RNC, in exercising its veto power over the original site designated by the police department and forcing the city to move the site 300 yards farther away, was motivated in substantial part by a desire to keep the focus on the convention and minimize the attention given to the speech of its critics. And that's classic censorship, and it has no place in our constitutional government.
Republican activist Tanya Milich talks about abortion, the gender gap, and the GOP.
The next group of Republican politicians, they may still disagree on the issues, which is where my gripe comes with both parties. But on the question of whether you bring women into the leadership, whether you hire them to be in top staff positions, even though the sexism still exists, it is so different than it was 25 years ago. And I believe that's because of the power of the women's political movement. It's made them say it's advantageous to have women in leadership and to run them for office.
And a young Latina organizer on this week's international gathering called by the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The Tutsi-led army took power in Burundi and has installed one of its own as president. The coup d'etat was widely expected since the president, a Hutu civilian, fled to the U.S. ambassador's home Tuesday evening, citing fears for his life. Although bloodless, the takeover effectively destroys a fragile experiment in democratic coalition government in this Central African country, which long has been riven by ethnic hatred between its dominant Tutsi minority and an 85% Hutu majority. Amway Corporation, which has given millions of dollars to Republican causes, has said that it is the unnamed corporate donor that gave the San Diego Tourist Bureau $1.3 million to help air coverage of the GOP convention next month on Pat Robertson's TV network. The Democratic National Committee said it would file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission accusing the GOP of accepting illegal corporate contributions. And Minnesota jumped a major hurdle yesterday in its efforts to sue tobacco companies. The state Supreme Court unanimously rejected industry arguments that the state's partner in its suit, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, had no legal right to sue for reimbursement for tobacco-related health care costs. An increasingly frustrated Richard Lamb has issued a list of questions he says must be answered if he's to have any chance of contesting for the presidential nomination of Ross Perot's Reform Party. Lamb has said in an interview that without access to the names of party members and details of how the process is being conducted, next month's nominating meeting in Long Beach, California, will be a coronation instead of a convention. The Urban Institute has estimated that the welfare legislation before Congress would increase the number of children in poverty by 1.1 million, or 12%. This according to a study released last night. The analysis of the legislation also estimates that families on welfare would lose on average about $1,000 a year once the bill is fully implemented. Including assistance from food stamps, more than a fifth of American families with children would be affected by the legislation. This again, according to the Urban Institute. And we got this note from the Washington Feminist FactsNet. This week's Brendan Sullivan Potted Palm Award, for those who do the most to make women invisible, goes to James P. Hoffa of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The Feminist FactsNet says the union, 30% female, rejected a name change this week in campaigning against a gender-free name. Hoffa, who's hoping to capture the IBT presidency next fall, said, quote, "Brotherhood is one of the great names in the English language. It's gender neutral. The definition of brotherhood is its neutral." And the Washington Feminist Facts Note says this: by that reasoning, the union could as easily be called the International Sisterhood of Teamsters. And you're listening to Democracy Now! A victory yesterday for groups planning to protest outside the Republican National Convention next month in San Diego. The Republican National Committee had moved the area reserved for political demonstrators away from the convention site in an attempt to marginalize protesters and limit media coverage of them. But a judge in California has ruled the RNC has no right to do that, and now demonstrations will take place in a lot directly across the street from the convention center. Jordan Budd, managing attorney of the ACLU in San Diego, argued the case. He spoke with Frank Stoltz of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Our clients, which include a number of the major protest groups intending to hold demonstrations at the time of the Republican National Convention, will now have an opportunity to communicate with their intended audience, the participants of the Republican National Convention. If the city and the RNC had succeeded in their attempt to move the demonstration site 300 yards farther away to a location that was blocked by trees and buildings and a variety of other obstructions, our clients would have been communicating with no one. No one would have seen them, their message would not have been heard, and their demonstrations would have been irrelevant.
Sounds like it was clearly an attempt to silence opposition voices. I mean, a clear attempt to stop freedom of speech?
The court's ruling rested explicitly on that finding.
It should be made clear that this demonstration area is not an area where people will be able to arrive and express their opposition to the Republican Party or to the U.S. government freely. There are some very strict guidelines. What are those, and how might those impinge on free speech?
Well, the site for demonstration activities will remain open, and people can come and go as they please. What will be regulated is access to the stage and the microphone. The police department has established a permitting procedure that provides 55-minute slots of time for permit holders to have exclusive use of the stage and the microphone. It is important to bear in mind, though, that this is only one of many, many, many venues that are available to citizens to engage in First Amendment-protected activities. During the week of the convention, just like any other day of any other year, citizens in this community can engage in free speech activities on sidewalks and streets and parks and other traditional public forums.
Granted, people can demonstrate in numerous other places in San Diego and exercise their free speech rights. The city, of course, will be flooded with law enforcement officers, particularly in the wake of the TWA disaster, which many believe was the result of an act of terrorism. Are there concerns on the ACLU's part that law enforcement may crack down in any way on people who try to do that? I think certainly there is many, many case studies, case history of that kind of activity on the part of law enforcement.
Well, that's something that we're always concerned about, and we take that as one of our primary responsibilities is being vigilant in observing law enforcement's response to constitutionally protected activities, such as the exercise of First Amendment rights. It is always the case in events of this nature that law enforcement often is motivated to overreact to try to maintain an image of sort of a sanitized image for a host city. And that sort of police response is inappropriate, and we are going to be scrutinizing the police's conduct very closely to make sure that that does not happen.
Jordan Budd of the San Diego ACLU speaking with Pacifica's Frank Stoltz. A judge yesterday ruled in favor of groups planning to protest outside the Republican National Convention next month in San Diego.
South by sunshine and hot air.
San Diego by the Four Men on their CD, What's Left, here on Democracy Now! In Washington yesterday, a group of pro-choice Republicans urged GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole to drop his support for the constitutional amendment banning abortion, that from the party's platform. Maine Senator Olympia Snow says that Dole should instead insist on language that urges continued debate on the issue, but takes no position on legalized abortion. The GOP's position on abortion is a major issue in the campaign, an issue some are sure will widen the gender gap in this election. Tanya Mielitz is a lifelong Republican activist and party official. She's the author of The Republican War Against Women, an insider's report from behind the lines. She spoke yesterday at a conference on women, the economy, and the elections here in Washington, D.C., and joins us on Democracy Now! Tanya Mielitz, how did you get involved in the Republican Party? Did you grow up in it?
Yes. My father was in the state legislature and was a candidate for governor in Utah. And from the time I was a child, I helped lick envelopes and pass out literature. And I was active in the College Young Republicans. And I have been a participant in so many Republican campaigns that I can't even count them. I've done everything in the Republican Party but be a candidate myself.
Why haven't you been a candidate?
When I had an opportunity to be a candidate in the 70s, I had young children, and I just didn't feel I could run for office. But I have been a campaign manager, and when the time came where I might have run for office, I really didn't want to anymore.
Are you one of the Mormon majority in Utah?
No, I come from a Mormon family three generations back, but my religious background is Baptist.
What's going on in the Republican Party today, particularly around the issue of abortion?
What's going on is the continuation of a strategy, electoral college strategy, to win the vote on the backlash that started in 1980 with Reagan and Bush, and it had to do with trying to bring fundamentalist religious people into the party who had been Democrats or who hadn't participated by supporting an issue like being against the legalization of abortion.
Now, isn't it true that even George Bush used to be for abortion?
Well, I don't know whether he was for abortion, but he was certainly not anti-choice. And he was one of the, when he was in the Congress in the late 60s, he was one of the leaders in the Republican Party of the family planning movement.
What happened?
Well, I think what happened was what happened to a lot of moderate Republican leaders, which was that after 1980, the party was winning its the White House by being against basic women's issues like a right to choose, because they could win these votes that I was talking about in the southern states. And it came to fruition certainly in the last couple of years when the Republican Party has replaced the Democratic Party as the party of the South.
Explain what you mean exactly by this electoral strategy.
What I mean was, in the days of the New Deal, when FDR got himself elected many times, and also Harry Truman, the base of the Democratic Party's vote was in the South. They had all those southern states to start with, and then they built on the states in the Midwest and the North. And the Republicans always had to depend upon putting together a strategy that connected New England with the Midwestern states and the Rocky Mountains, and then everybody fought over places like California and Illinois. But it was a given that the South was for the Democrats. When the Civil Rights Movement came along, the Republicans, for the first time with Barry Goldwater, broke in solidly in the South. They won the four Dixiecrat states of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and South Carolina, as well as Georgia and Arizona. And what that meant was that Barry Goldwater opposed the Civil Rights Act, and he ran on a states' rights platform. And that was the beginning of the breaking open of the South by the Republican Party. Along comes the women's movement in the early 70s, and there was a backlash developed very quickly over the ERA. And by the mid-70s, it was clear that you could win votes from those same southern states, or the old Confederate states now. You could take votes away from the Democrats by being against the goals of the women's movement.
Now, where did Jimmy Carter fit into this?
Well, Jimmy Carter is very interesting because he stopped modestly the movement of the Republicans to take over those states, because he was is a born-again Christian, and these religious Southerners who were moving into the Republican Party, many of them were not terribly active, and they voted in many of those states for Jimmy Carter. However, one of the things that's not known is that Phyllis Schlafly, who was a very strong organizer against the ERA, was organizing with the help of Sam Ervin, a Democrat of North Carolina, in the mid-70s, before Jimmy Carter. And it is not correct to say that it was Jimmy Carter that brought the religious Southerners into politics, but it was really Phyllis Schlafly's organizing before 76 that really politicized people who had done really no more than vote before. They were not political people.
The anti-choice movement as it is today that began around the Reagan-Bush time, organizing for Reagan and Bush, is beyond anti-choice. In many ways, it's anti-woman. How did that start?
Well, that goes back to something that is deep in our history. I mean, even back into the 19th century, and that is a fundamentalist interpretation of women's role in the world. It's a patriarchal view of the world that God says that women should obey men, and that the natural law of things is not an equal partnership between men and women, but that women should obey what the male members of their household dictate. And you've seen this through the years. And what happened is, when we had the women's movement come along, you had a movement that said women should be treated as equal partners, which was opposite in its view of the world to this fundamentalist view. And it was very alarming for people who believed in this fundamentalist view. And the issues that got them involved first was the ERA and the abortion issue, but there were other issues. And by the mid-70s, there was the Moral Majority came along, and this then became a political movement that grew, eventually became, through Pat Robertson and then Ralph Reed, the Christian Coalition. And they became a new factor, a major factor, in the Republican Party.
In the speech you gave earlier, you talked about the Republican Party actually being the party of women in the 1940s. How do you substantiate that?
Well, let's go back even earlier. I'll give you a little bit more background. The Republican Party started in 1854, and the driving force was abolition. But many of the people who were involved in that were also supportive of women's rights. And it wasn't until 1912, when the party split over Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, that there was even a debate, a serious debate, that women's rights and women's vote shouldn't be continue to be part of the Republican Party. So you move up to the late 30s, when the Democrats were doing very well, and Eleanor Roosevelt was beginning to be well known and was working for women's rights, and FDR had appointed Frances Perkins. And Republican Party felt they needed to do things to reinforce their past history. So at the 1940 Republican Convention, they passed support for the ERA, which the Democratic Party did not support at that time. In 1940, they also passed a regulation, that gave equal representation on the committees to men and women, which they didn't have in the Democratic Party.
And we'll find out why the Republican Party changed after that when we come back from our break. Our guest is Tanya Milich, pro-choice Republican activist. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we continue with our conversation with Tanya Milich, lifelong Republican activist and party official, and author of The Republican War Against Women, an insider's report from behind the lines. So, Tanya Milich, why did the Republican Party change from its pro-woman, pro-ERA stance in the 1940s?
What happened is what we started this program about. As the years passed, neither the Democrats or the Republicans were being terrific to women. But there was still this tradition, and then when it became evident that the Republicans might be able to win the White House by being opposed to women's movement, this particular group began to move into the Republican Party. But on a state and local level, there were still many places in the country, and are now, where the party is very supportive of women's rights.
Now you have Bob Dole, who spent almost four decades in Congress. Where has he fit into this progression or regression, however you want to see it, of the Republican Party?
Well, Bob Dole is a very interesting man because he comes out of the old right, not the new right, not the Goldwater wing or what became the new right later on. And that old right wing was supportive of the Lincoln traditions, the kind of things I was just talking about. In the early 70s, when he was National Committee chairman, he was a supporter of the ERA. He was a backer of many, many things that were helpful to women, equal pay for equal work. He supported the child care planks in the 1972 platform. And one didn't even know what his position was on abortion. And no one knew until 1974, or at least I haven't found anybody from Kansas who could talk about it, until after Roe v. Wade. And in 1974, he believes, and I think that's probably correct from the data that people have analyzed that elections, that he won that election because of right to life votes. This was the 74 election in Kansas, where Republicans were under attack across the country. They were losing because of the Watergate scandals. And I think that probably cemented his belief that being anti-choice was going to be helpful to him electorally.
In fact, he lived at the Watergate. He was head of the Republican National Committee, and he said on the issue of the Watergate burglars, I had taken the night off. But he did run against a doctor, in fact, and he made abortion a key issue with those calling for a human life amendment, I believe.
And what is phenomenal is that you then moved to the 76th convention, and Bob Dole was the architect of the plank. It's not the plank we have in 80, but it was the beginning of the movement of the Republican Party toward an anti-choice position. The constitutional amendment is mentioned in that plank, but it also talks about tolerance and respects for pro-choice positions. So it was an attempt to kind of have a big tent, but the point is that Bob Dole was on that platform committee and was one of the architects of that. And that, to remind your listeners, was the year that Gerry Ford almost lost the nomination to Ronald Reagan.
So now we have today, and we have Bob Dole waffling back and forth, not on the issue of choice, but whether to put in a tolerance plank in addition to the anti-abortion plank. First of all, does that mean anything to you, this tolerance plank, once they still have the anti-abortion plank in it? And what is going on here?
It doesn't mean anything because the base point, the point that those of us who have worked on this issue was that the plank ought to be dropped, that the platform ought to be silent on the issue, and that people could then make their own choices on what they believed, whether they were pro-choice or anti-choice. As for these language about tolerance planks, there are statements in the 1992 platform and other platforms that already talk about the Republican Party opposes bigotry and supports tolerance. So what you've had for the last 6 weeks, however long this tolerance plank statement, it's just been smoke and mirrors. It's just been Mickey Mouse. It means nothing because the basic position of the party has not changed at all.
So where does this leave you? First of all, will you be going to the Republican convention in San Diego?
I'm going, but in a different role this time. I was an insider before this time. I am by choice an outsider. And since I had written about this in my book, I felt that I needed to go out to San Diego and watch the end of this, and I will then rewrite the last chapter. The book will be changed next year, and I'm going with a tape recorder, and I will speak out, and I will keep a diary. But I'm not organizing with the people who, the pro-choice Republicans that I used to work with.
What do you expect will happen at the platform hearings just before the convention?
I think that the arrangement has already been made as far as the plank is concerned. It's clear, Dole has said, and after he met with Henry Hyde and Ralph Reed, that the plank stays, the anti-choice plank stays. And in addition, now it will have a sentence attacking President Clinton's veto of the third trimester abortions, or partial birth, as they like to call it. The other interesting question is what will be put into the platform that will make it appear that the party is now the party of women? Will there be anything about, say, child care? Will there be anything more on family medical leave? Issues that relate to education of women. First, Dole introduced a bill that would get rid of affirmative action. Now, I noticed that he pulled back on that statement. What will they do about saying how are women going to get equal pay with equal as men do if you do not bring women in through affirmative action without quotas, which is what I support? Then how are you going to deal with the fact that women still don't get treated on an equal playing field with men? So there may be something in those areas that we haven't seen yet.
Again, we're talking with Tanya Mielich, author of The Republican War Against Women, an insider's report from behind the lines. In a minute, I want to ask you what has been the Republican Party, particularly the leadership, people like Gingrich, also people like Ralph Reed, their response to your book. But before that, what about the vice presidential candidate? Do you think it's conceivable that Bob Dole would choose a pro-choice candidate?
Well, I think it's always possible, conceivable. I mean, we could argue about what that means. I think that the selection of the vice president is dependent upon the Electoral College strategy that they use. They are so far behind that they need to have someone on the ticket that is going to bring them votes. So they either pick one of the governors, and my thought is they might go with a U.S. senator like Connie Mack of Florida, because they need Florida, and Florida is a state that could go either way, despite Clinton being ahead right now, or they could go with someone like Pennsylvania Governor Ridge, who was called a multiple choice rather than an anti-choice.
What does that mean?
That means that you are for the basic, you believe in Roe v. Wade, but then you're not willing to support help for poor women. You're only for the basic thing, but not for how you implement the basic choice.
In fact, Pennsylvania has one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. Does Tom Ridge support that?
My understanding is that he does. But he's very different from someone who is strongly anti-choice, like, say, Governor Engler of Michigan or Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin. But having given the platform on the social issues to the Christian Coalition people, then Bob Dole, given that he's a senior statesman, maybe recognizing this is a crucial point in the direction of the party long after he's gone. This is the direction of the 21st century party, because whomever is picked to be the vice presidential candidate becomes the heir apparent, whether they win or lose, becomes a very important part of the direction of the Republican Party in the year 2000, the year 2004.
Senator Connie Mack, this is not a name that we've heard bandied about for the Republican vice presidential candidate. What is his position on choice and on the economy?
Connie Mack is anti-choice and is a supply-sider.
Which means to you?
That means that he supports very strong tax cuts as a way to bring about a more vibrant economy, or as it's now called, a growth economy, and he would be in the same group of people as Steve Forbes on those, and Jack Kemp. So that's where he fits on the economic. And it's the idea behind it is that you have enormous tax cuts and you have cuts in government spending, and between the two of those, that's supposed to somehow bring down the deficit.
Mm-hmm. And what makes you think he's a possibility?
Because Bob Dole needs to win those southern states. If my assumption is correct and the polls indicate that he can't win California, so you have to go to a place where you can win a lot of votes. And if you continue on the kind of strategy I was talking about, then you go to the South, and the president and the vice president come from Arkansas and Tennessee, so they get those two states, and the rest of the South has to go for Dole if he's to win, and the state where they might lose, they, the Republicans, would be Florida. So you put Connie Mack on the ticket to deliver Florida.
Given the plank of the Republican Party, where do governors like William Weld, who is considered pro-choice in Massachusetts, Christine Todd Whitman of New Jersey, where do they stand? And what do you think of in the days of the Republican convention? You're going to hear from, we're going to hear speeches from Christine Todd Whitman, Susan Molinari, the Republican New York Congress member that has been chosen as the keynote address on the first night.
They are good Republicans, and what they will do, they will stand and say, I support the presidential nominee and the vice president. However, I disagree on the issue of choice, and then they will go back to their states. And in the case of William Weld, I think he will spend his time working on the U.S. Senate race. Christy Todd Whitman will probably do what she can to help the ticket. It's always that. I would compare it, for those of your listeners who were Democrats, to how maybe the Kennedy people felt in 1980 when Jimmy Carter won the nomination. They didn't think he should have. Or Jesse Jackson in 1984. It's a typical question we always have in American politics. Are you for the party unity first, or are you an issue person?
But it's one thing to have different points of view. It's another thing to say that your point of view, if the Republican Party prevails, will be outlawed in this country, or at least what you believe should happen will be outlawed in the country.
Well, you'll have to talk to them about that. I can only tell you that I think that the strategy has gone too far, and that the reason I had to write this book is that I felt that if people who felt pro-choice like I were, that this was the time to speak out. and that this insidious strategy that wins votes on a backlash does not deserve to be part of our politics, whether it's left or right. We can argue over tax policy, and we can argue about foreign policy, and we can have different interpretations on the environment and how we're going to deal with it. But in a country of ours at this time, we should be respecting what was supposed to be life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all people, not just for some people.
Now the reaction to your book from the Republican Party, particularly the leadership.
Most of the leadership has ignored it, tried to ignore it, but because the press keeps asking about them, they have to say. And some people have said, she's not a real Republican. People who know me laugh. I've been around the party for a very, very long time, so that kind of discrediting doesn't work. So then the next thing is to attack me as shrill and having hysterics and a diatribe. If you bother to read the book, it isn't very hysterical at all. I tried very hard to write it interestingly, but like a lawyer's brief, so the points are in there. Then there are those who just say they disagree with me, and that's fine. That's a fair. Some people have one interpretation; I have another. But as far as the first two, it doesn't wash. Then there are the people that I've known in the party who agree with me, who say we're very glad you did this. Terrific.
Do you know Newt Gingrich? Do you know Bob Dole? Do you know Ralph Reed?
I have never met Ralph Reed. I've seen him. I watched him with Phyllis Schlafly at the 92 convention. Watched him very closely. He's very impressive as a political operative, but I do not know him. Newt Gingrich, I first got not to know. It was a telephone conversation. I worked for Nelson Rockefeller's campaign in 1968, and Newt was for president, and Newt was the coordinator down, I believe it was Tulane, for Nelson Rockefeller, and we always remembered him, those of us who were working in the offices, because he was always so colorful on the phone. Years later, I met him when he was in New York for a GOPAC fundraiser, and he met with a group of us, pro-choice women, and it was right after the Webster decision, and we were all very angry. The Webster decision was the decision that was the beginning of taking the legal abortion away from everyone. And we were very angry, and we had a three-hour conversation with Newt.
What year was it?
1990, and I describe it in my book. And I must tell you that Newt listened. That's the interesting thing about Newt, is that Newt listened. And I think that he's a different kind of new right politician than some of the others, in the sense that not only did he listen to people whom we thought he disagreed with, but then you look at who he put into his leadership. And I've been very critical over the years of the Democratic Party for not ever putting someone like Pat Schroeder onto a committee. It's no excuse that the seniority didn't allow some of these Democratic women to go into congressional leadership positions. Newt, recognizing the power of the women's movement and the value of having women support him, brought Susan Molinari into the leadership, Enid Waltos, for what it was worth. I mean, she got on the Rules Committee. I think that in that sense, we are into a new phase, that the next group of Republican politicians, they may still disagree on the issues, which is where my gripe comes with both parties, but on the question of whether you bring women into the leadership, whether you hire them to be in top staff positions, even though the sexism still exists, it is so different than it was 25 years ago, and I believe that's because of the power of the women's political movement. It's made them say it's advantageous to have women in leadership and to run them for office.
If we were to have the election today, do you think Bob Dole could win?
If it were held today, no. However, I would remind your listeners that in 1988, George Bush had a major problem with women. There was a huge gender gap in favor of Mike Dukakis in the middle of the summer. I believe at one point it was as high as 28%. And guess who won the election? George Bush beat Dukakis. And while the numbers continue to hold in favor of Clinton, I wouldn't count Bob Dole out yet, but I don't think they've got much time left. That's why the choice of the vice president will be a signal for the direction that the party, that the Dole campaign will head.
Let me end on the question of the wives, Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Dole. Would you say that Elizabeth Dole has an even stronger connection to the fundamentalist right than her husband, Bob Dole? I mean, she herself, would you call her a fundamentalist?
No, I wouldn't, but I would say that the first part of your question, I would agree with you that her connections are, because my impression is that her, she has a very deep faith the Christian Coalition people seem to respect and understand. I think that they are a little more leery of where Bob Dole is. He doesn't show his religion on his sleeve. He doesn't make inspiring speeches at Christian Coalition meetings about religion. He talks about issues. He's a man of Washington. He talks about what he knows, and it doesn't necessarily, it isn't the kinds of language that you hear from his wife. But to say she's a fundamentalist, I wouldn't put her there, because I don't believe, just on the basis of how she has lived her life, even in more recent years, if you define fundamentalism the way I do, it would mean that she wouldn't be the kind of professional woman she is.
Tanya Milich, thanks very much for joining us. Tanya Milich is author of The Republican War Against Women, an insider's report from behind the lines. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Center for Responsive Politics has just put out a report saying that Wall Street is investing heavily in its Washington agenda, giving $11.3 million in campaign contributions during the 96 election cycle to federal campaigns and to parties. The top donor is Goldman Sachs, the former investment firm of Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin. Goldman Sachs also was one of the major beneficiaries of the $20 billion bailout of Mexico by the U.S. government. Almost all that money didn't go south of the border. It went to Wall Street. This weekend in Chiapas, the southernmost state of Mexico, thousands of progressive activists from around the world are gathering for a conference sponsored by the Zapatistas. The Zapatistas burst into the headlines January 1, 1994, the day NAFTA went into effect. They said NAFTA will further impoverish the desperately poor Mayan Indians of Mexico. This week's conference is called An International Meeting in Favor of Humanity and Against Neoliberalism. Neoliberalism, the doctrine of free market transnational corporate control. About 250 people from the states are expected to attend the week-long meeting in Chiapas, many of them young people who've been inspired by the Zapatistas. One of those activists making her way to Chiapas is Mariana Mora, a 22-year-old recent graduate of the University of California who now works with an Oakland, California-based youth group. She spoke with about the Zapatista conference with Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky.
Mariana Mora, the Zapatistas only seem to come to the attention of people in the United States when there's some sort of major conflict, when something happens, a clash between soldiers and peasants, or Subcomandante Marcos is interviewed by some famous American journalist. And yet the Zapatistas are constantly organizing and continue to exist in the state of Chiapas, doing the work that they do, trying to get land to the peasants and oppose the programs of the government that are harmful to the peasants. But they don't often call for people from around the world to come to Chiapas to talk to them. Why are they asking for that now in the summer of 1996?
Well, actually, the EZLN from the very beginning, if one looks at their comunicados and the things that they state in their documents, always make a calling internationally. It's always to the brothers and sisters of Mexico and to the brothers and sisters in solidarity in the international level. For two main reasons. First of all, because they recognize that the global situation calls for people to unite. While our governments are joining forces with all the free trade pacts and different agreements that they're signing, civil society must also unite together if we are to combat poverty and the things that they are calling for, which are basic needs, which is health, education, land, liberty, shelter. So that's for one reason. And the second reason is for their own security and protection. The only thing that is, the main thing that has kept the EZLN from being massacred has been international presence, has been international support, has been that every single time that there's a crisis in Mexico, there's so much response internationally.
So they may feel particularly threatened for one reason or another now, and they want observers to come down and witness to the fact that they still exist and that they hold the land that they do?
On one front, yes. For example, when the EZLN had the Continental Forum Against Neoliberalism and for Humanity, which was held in April of this year, they held it in April for a very strategic moment. April is the end of the dry season, which is when the Mexican military is most active and most hostile, most likely to provoke a confrontation. So they held the conference in April, knowing that with so much international presence from people from all over the continent, that would be able to contain the violence somewhat.
There is violence going on down there all the time that we don't hear about, isn't there? I just looked on the Associated Press the day we're doing this interview and found out that in a place called Venustiano Carranza, at least 17 Indian peasants have died in battles over land in the last couple of months. This is pretty much going on throughout Chiapas, isn't it? And we don't hear about it.
Yeah, there's a low-intensity warfare strategy basically being placed in throughout the conflict zone. Again, because the government knows that because of international presence, they can't go and wipe everyone out. Therefore, they've resorted to more low-intensity strategies. For example, there's a lot of violence, mainly sexual violence, directed against women. And right now, this situation is really, really difficult and very repressive in the north of Chiapas, in Tila, where there's and in that zone where there's different paramilitary groups that have complete impunity and have killed many people.
A lot of the Mexican people responded to the Zapatistas when they first surfaced, and it was clear that the movement was not confined to a few hundred or a few thousand guerrillos in the poorest part of Mexico, or one of the poorest parts of Mexico. People throughout the country seemed to rally to their cause, and public opinion polls, I remember, said, yeah, we like the idea of an uprising against this government. What's happened in the last 2.5 years? Do you think that there's still a current of support in Mexico, or has the inevitable passage of time made people doubt that a small guerrilla movement in a place like Chiapas could succeed?
Both. I think that in some level there has been this waiting game that the government has done has been effective at some level. I think that there's been not a loss of support, but sort of looking for other ways besides that they recognize, and even the Zapatistas say that they're not the only force that's going to change Mexico. It has to come from all angles. And I think if one looks at the situation and the social organizations that are surfacing in Mexico and the tactics that they're using, the Zapatistas have definitely been very impacting and very influential in what's being staged in different parts of the country right now. And it's happening from all different fronts, which is what the EZLN eventually wants. They want things to be chipped away from not all angles and not to come solely from them.
There are other movements against the government in Mexico. There's El Barzón, which is a group of middle-class people who are protesting against the high rates of interest and the impossible to pay mortgages. There's a new movement of guerrilleros that seems to have surfaced in Guerrero State, although people have questions about whether or not that's real and why it surfaced now. Mexico would seem to be a continually unstable place. I'm thinking, is that your understanding of it too, politically?
Politically and economically, if one looks at the economic situation right now in Mexico, one understands why there's so much instability. In last year alone, 2.5 million people lost their jobs. The amount of underemployment and unemployment is astronomical. While people's salaries have been frozen, the prices of basic grains, of tortillas, of corn has risen. People just can't take it anymore.
The situation here would be the same as if we were making the same money that we do, whatever it is that we do, and all of a sudden bread costs 2 or 3 times as much, gasoline costs 2 or 3 times as much, and we didn't have the money to pay for it. So people are squeezed. What do they do? In the poorest of circumstances, what do they do? In Chiapas, for example, the area where the Zapatistas are active.
Well, the way that people have resisted or have responded to the situation has been by forming different centers of resistance. There are places that are called Aguascalientes, named after the first Aguascalientes in Chiapas, which was an area that the EZLN created for civil society, for dialogue. Which
and appropriately was, enough, it means hot water.
Yeah. It was actually where the Constitution was drafted after the Mexican Revolution, so it, symbolically the name is was it was named that as a way of transition to a new nation, which was the very first location. Aguascalientes of 94 was just, that was the very first place destroyed by the military in the offensive of February of 95. So the people responded by saying, well, if you're going to destroy this place for us, well, then we're going to build 4 more. And they did. They built 4 Aguascalientes. Now a 5th one has been inaugurated. There are places where the community decides collectively and unanimously to reject any form of government assistance and instead decides to seek assistance from members of civil society from Mexico, from other parts of Mexico, internationally, to help in the process of self-determination and self-sufficiency.
I've never been to Chiapas. I've been to other rural areas in Mexico, and I've been struck, as most North Americans, I imagine, would be struck by the amazing poverty that one sees in rural areas of Mexico. One statistic says that in Chiapas, for example, 54% of the people are malnourished, and 15,000 people die every year of diseases that otherwise would be curable. What can these focos of resistance, these Aguascalientes, do to cure and make people's situations better if they have so few resources? Sharing stuff is fine, but if you have nothing to share, what can you do?
There's actually been a lot of resources and a lot of support that has gone to these centers of resistance. For example, in April, when a delegation came from the U.S., we contributed $8,000 to the Center of Resistance of Oventic in the highlands of Chiapas. Money or resources are never donated to an individual, even if it's a gift. It's given to the community as a whole, and then the community decides what to do with it. So in this case, for example, in Oventic, the women commanders of the EZLN whom we met with, were asking for the money in order to start a women's arts and crafts cooperative. Their weaving being the main source of income for the women. And since there is no electricity and women can usually only weave at night after they finished all their daily tasks, they needed a generator and a warehouse to be able to do their weaving at night and be able to buy things in bulk, etc.
I'm always interested as a journalist in how people learn what's going on anywhere and the media situation. And as I said before, the Zapatistas were kind of internationally fashionable for a while, and everybody wanted to interview Subcomandante Marcos. And then that went away, and the amount of freelance reporting that I saw coming out of various parts of Chiapas diminished down to almost nothing. Occasionally you hear a report on Pacifica Radio, but that's about it these days, or an article in a progressive magazine. I wonder what is being done on the ground. Do they have micro radio transmitters? Are there underground papers? What's being done to circulate the word of the actual situation of the people in Chiapas to each other and to the outside world and the rest of Mexico?
There's different groups that have provided technical assistance, not necessarily to the EZLN, but to the communities in the area, to making sure that they have radio equipment and are able to communicate with each other. But in terms of distributing information nationally, internationally, the main source, by far the most popular, has been the internet. I mean, I think that has drastically changed the way one looks at a rebel movement like the Zapatistas. For example, it's sort of interesting. In April, when we were in La Realidad, one has this image of transporting messages on a little piece of paper, and you have to go past the military checkpoints or et cetera. But in this case, it was the EZLN that gave us a disc that had Marcos' inauguration speech on it, and we took our disc over to San Cristobal and then put it on the computer, and then it went on PeaceNet, and the whole world found out about it. So it's sort of a guerrilla movement in postmodern times, which has really been able to help and distribute information. Here you can get La Jornada, a Mexican newspaper daily, on Netscape. And all of the comunicados, all of the information gets transferred on cyberspace.
Do you yourself log on pretty much every day to see what's happening in Chiapas?
Several times a day.
Several times a day. Let me ask you about this conference that you're going to, this week-long conference about neoliberalism, this word that's used over and over again. You faxed me the invitation communique, which is in the inimitable, ironic, humorous style of Subcomandante Marcos. And he says at one point, we should not think of neoliberalism as moral and an ethical value, not only because the discussion loses all meaning here, but also because neoliberalism supposes the abolition of all morals and all ethical values. Now, neoliberalism, he's talking about a worldwide movement here. What do you expect to discuss and do in a week in Chiapas to impact this multinational phenomenon?
It's part of the process. I mean, I think that the EZLN have been very effective in learning how to use certain tactics that are meant to instigate dialogue, not necessarily worldwide, though that is definitely an objective, but mainly in your community. So these encuentros aren't the objective. It's the process that's the objective. It's the having this form as an excuse to get people dialoguing and discussing in their own communities. So, for example, with the Comité Emiliano Zapata, which I'm a part here in Oakland, we had a series of mini forums on neoliberalism and invited different members of unions, of different community organizations, of non-governmental organizations, not-profit students, etc., and also attended different organizations' meetings to ask what their opinion was on how this globalization of the economy, this downsizing, this Reaganomics, whatever term you want to put on it, has impacted California. And also what forms of resistance can we see in our communities. So that form of dialogue, that's the objective that the Zapatistas have for holding these encuentros. Now, the encuentro is a space then for people from all over the world to be able to share these experiences collectively after they've gathered the opinions from people in their communities.
And when you come back, what can you do with this information? Can you call the San Francisco Chronicle? Can you call Channel 4? Or do you have to keep operating on the level of we can meet with who we can meet with, who's interested in us, and construct this movement from below without any establishment media even taking notice of us?
Several of us are writing articles. There's going to be a video that's going to be produced, different photographs, and we're going to be trying to distribute the information as much as possible.
And finally, what do you think, Mariana Mora, you're going to see down there in Chiapas this time that may have changed since you were last there in April? You've been there three times in the last 2.5 years. Since you were there just 3 or 4 months ago, do you expect to see any change, any visible change that would encourage you or discourage you or impress you one way or the other?
Change goes slowly, and I think the EZLN realizes that this isn't something that's going to be won in my generation. Maybe my grandchildren are going to see the impact of what we're fighting for now. I think we're in the beginning stages of a process. It's going to take a long time. So you don't see any changes that are drastic in terms of solid improvements. Now, the things that you do see are, for example, the military advances. 3 months ago, there weren't paved roads in many areas, and now the military's paved it because it's easier for them to get back and forth from the
They're not doing that to help the peasants have better lives.
No, they're using that so they can go and move quicker in whatever case they may need to do that. So, however, there has been some really interesting improvements that have happened in the short term in terms of infrastructure and resources of the communities. To use the case of Oventica again, before January of 96, the community was a bunch of houses, but there wasn't any other structure or any other building or anything. And then when it declared itself a center of resistance, people from all over the community, for the surrounding communities and from parts of Mexico came and helped construct what they now have, which is a women's center. They have a library, they have a soccer field, they have a cultural center, they have a warehouse to store their food supplies, and they're teaching different people of the community to be health workers and teachers, etc. So that is something, improvements that you see definitely in the short term, which are basic infrastructure that is really needed. There's also other organizations, non-governmental organizations, that are providing technical assistance for those communities.
Mariana Mora, thank you very much for joining us on Pacifica. She's on her way to the Encuentro Intercontinental por la Humanidad y contra el Neoliberalismo, the intercontinental meeting for humanity and against neoliberalism. I'm Larry Bensky in Berkeley, California.
And thank you for that interview, Larry. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. That's the number to call. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!